All right, we're ready for chapters 23 to 25 of the book of Genesis. And we have a little bit of ground to cover, as we always do. This is the outline we're following. We're in the patriarchal section. We are under point 2A, 1 and 2. We'll talk about Abraham and Isaac, and next time we'll get into the third section on Jacob. Those are the patriarchs, as we will be talking about as time goes on. Let's review our chapters, but instead of taking each one, we're going to just kind of skip to some. Chapter 1 was, 6 days of creation. Chapter 4 was Cain and Abel. Chapter 7, the flood. Chapter 9, very good. Chapter 11, Tower of Babel, very good. Chapter 13, Chapter 15, war between the kings. That's chapter 14. You're right, the covenant is being assured. You're correct, I was wrong. Chapter 17 stands out. Circumcision, as a sign of the covenant. Let's go to chapter 20. Abimelech takes Sarah. Chapter 22. The offering of Isaac. Now, that's not every chapter, but that kind of challenges a little bit to remember them out of order. All right, here's chapter 23 in answer to question one. And that is Sarah's death and her burial. Two things happen in the chapter. We'll subdivide the second section here in just a moment. But here's the first thing that happens is Sarah dies at 127 in verses 1 and 2. That Sarah lived 127 years, and these were the years of the life of Sarah. And we'll stop there, and we'll talk about where that took place at verse 2 in a second. But she dies at 127. Abraham is 137 at the time, and will live 38 more years beyond this. We'll read of his death here in a little bit, but that's going to be jumping 38 years for what that may be worth to you. Now at verse 2, it tells us where she died, and the text said she died at Kirjath Arba, that is at Hebron in the land of Canaan. And Abraham came and mourned for her, and he wept for her. Where is that? Well, Hebron is right here in the middle of my circle. Kirjath Arba, or Hebron, same place. That's where she died. So that's verses 1 and 2. All right? We're more interested now in the fact that he bought a burial spot for her and the significance of that and what that tells us. So let's subdivide the next section here of Abraham buying a burial spot from Ephron. And he bought the cave of Machpelah. We'll talk about the significance of that in a moment. Let's get ahead of ourselves, lest I forget to make this point. When we get down to verse 17 and 18 in a moment, the field of Ephron was deeded to Abram. This is the first of the land of Canaan that Abram or his descendants have occupied and owned. Now, they've lived in Beersheba. Abraham and Sarah have been there, and now she's dying, and he's going to buy some land. Now, there's some significance of him buying that land. We'll get to that when we get to the end of this section. But this is the first instance of them occupying or owning land, and this is the first purchase of that, and that's going to be a significant point, even to this day, as you're going to see on the screen in just a moment. All right. We have six things to go through in this section. First of all, Abraham requested a burial spot in verses 3 and 4. He stood up from his dead, from his weeping, and he spoke to the sons of Heth. And what did he say at verse 3 or verse 4? Yes, I'm a sojourner, I'm a foreigner. This is your land here. I would like some of the land. Give me some of this land. He doesn't mean by that, give it to me without a purchase, but he's meaning, how, as we're going to see later, I want to purchase some land. So let me have some land here that I might bury the dead out of my sight. Now, we're going to see more about that in a moment. We learned some very basic things about how the burial brings closure in death and of a loved one, and furthermore, it bestows some honor, and so he's wanting to do that. We'll say more about that if time permits later. Well, at verses 5 and 6, the sons of Heth said to him, what? Get anything you want. In fact, and I'm paraphrasing, there's not anybody among us that would deny you whatever they want. So you just pick out the land, and if it belongs to him, he'll give it to you. If him or her or whoever it may be, they're going to let you have that. That's verses 5 and 6. Pick out the choicest place for a burial place, and we'll not withhold anything from you. So then Abram stood up, and the text says, beginning at verse 7, that he requested the cave of Machpelah. We'll talk about it in a moment. But it belonged to Ephron, who was the son of Zor. He said that verse 8, that I might bury the dead out of my sight. And so y'all approach Ephron for me and see if he will let me have that. So beginning now at verse 10 through 16, what does Ephron say? Yeah, you can have whatever you wish, and if that's what you want, then you can have that. Now notice in verse 11, no, my Lord, he said, I give you the field of the cave and the cave with it. I give it in the presence of the sons that you might bury your dead. And Abram bowed himself. Now, the significance of him bowing himself, I think, shows that's often what would be done before someone superior, someone who is of royalty or someone who's a king. And so these are at least his equal. And they reverence Abraham as being a mighty man in the land, and they talk about that. But that's showing respect and honor for these people, that I'm not demanding you give me this land because I'm the great Abraham, but I'm requesting that of you. He bows before them in their presence. But anyway, verse 12, he bowed himself before them, and he spoke to Ephraim, saying, if you give it to me, give it to me for money. And it seems, though some suggested he's never doing that. One commentator said this is a bargaining practice among the Orientals, that I'll give that to you, but he means I'm going to sell it to you. And then here's the price, and he shoots it way high and hoping it'll be bargained down. It seems perhaps that he's offering to give it to him. I don't know that that's the case. The Orientals did that, but that is not to always give. But it seems that he offers to give it because Abraham insists on what? I want to pay you for that. He said, my Lord, listen to me. The land is worth 400 shekels of silver. This is Ephron speaking. And he said, what is that between me and you? So bury your dead. I take that whatever the price is, both are wealthy men. And this value of this land, and that's hard to determine what that stands for. The 400 shekels of silver is not shekels as in coins, but has to do with the weight. And so what does that translate to in our time? I don't know. And I haven't found a commentator that wants to venture into that, because when he does, he dates it to the time that he wrote his commentary. And if it was in the 50s, that's out of kelter with now. So how much is that worth? I don't know. But in their estimation, I'm taking that Ephron is saying, it's a small amount compared to the wealth that we have. So just take the land. But Abraham is insisting, saying that he would buy the land. And so now at verse 16, Abram listened and weighed out the silver and that had been named. That was the currency of merchants. In other words, this is how things were normally done. And so he pays the price. All right, he insisted on buying that. Reckon why that's, does that remind you of another circumstance earlier? Abram did not want earlier it be said. Yeah. Absolutely. So he insisted the first spot of ground that he owns or his family owns, he's paid for that and he's purchased that. Perhaps that's part of the significance of that. Finish this section here, And then we're going to draw some conclusions from that. So verse 17 and 18, we've already talked about how the field has been deeded to him. So they go through the process, whether that's a verbal or it's some other kind of writing. I'm not sure. We're not told. But he gives him the money and it's deeded to him. So now you are the owner of this field and of this cave. And now then we're down to verse 19. And Abraham buries his loved one out of his sight. And notice at verse 19 that he finds the cave of Machpelah before Mamre. The word before means opposite or facing. Opposite of Mamre in the land of Canaan. And that had been deeded to him and he has it for a burial spot. Now what does that tell you? What does that story tell you beginning here at verse 3 through verse 20? What do you learn from that? Well-respected man, and he respected those he was around. Very good. All right. Good point. Do you think maybe that this is a little bit of a test of faith? Because they're not occupying, Abraham's descendants are not occupying the land yet. Abraham is there, but instead of taking his wife back to his homeland, he doesn't do that. He buries her in the land that God's promised to him. That tells me that Abraham had faith in the promise that this was going to be his land. And so he buys some land at the cave of Machpelah, at Mamre or at Hebron, in answer to that promise. That makes sense. I believe we're going to come into this land. I believe this is where my descendants are going to be. I believe we're going to occupy this land. Some have suggested this was also an effort to keep the family in Canaan. That this keeps the family where this is where the patriarch is going to be buried. And if secular history tells us anything, this is where Isaac would have been buried. This is where Abraham was buried. This is where Jacob was buried. This is where many of the patriarchs were buried. Does that make sense? And so this was an effort, perhaps, though the text doesn't tell us that, to keep them in the land. Now let's pause for a moment and talk about where this was. This is at Hebron, right here, is where the cave of Machpelah was. This is another little map showing Machpelah just a little ways from Hebron, not very far. This is a modern structure. I say modern structure. That was built by Herod the Great. There was, we're told, around the cave of Machpelah that King David secured the area and built something around it, but not these high walls. This was supposedly built by Herod the Great. Those walls are about 8 feet in thickness, I think, is what I'm told. The problem with that is we're not 100% sure this is the exact location of the burial spot of Abraham. Though tradition has handed it down, and many scholars suggest, perhaps so. Can we be 100% sure? No. But a little bit about that, for what it's worth, this is a top view of that, but you see these little domes right here. Let me give you a little insight on that. Those little domes are identified right here as being Sarah's chamber and Abraham's chamber. So going back, that Sarah is buried beneath that, not just beneath the dome, but down in the earth, down way on down, stories down in the cave, down below that, and Abraham's supposed to be buried below the other one. Are they? Some question. Others say most likely that's the case, that they were buried there. But anyway, that's a spot in Hebron that's greatly revered among Jews. Muslims occupied that for a while. Jews have occupied that. Quote, Christians have occupied that, have built onto it, added to it, and some have torn parts of it down. But since King Herod, that has been standing and been erected. All right, anything else before we get to the longest chapter in the book of Genesis? All right, let's go to chapter 24. Four things happen here. This is Rebekah is found for Isaac. So we've got a lot going on tonight. We've got a funeral and a burial, and then we've got a wedding, and then we're going to have another funeral before it's over. And then we're going to have family scattering. And so we got a lot of activity going on in Genesis 23, 24, and 25. All right, so Rebekah is found. Abraham commanded his servant to find a wife for Isaac in verses 1 to 9. So let's get underway with that and see what's being said there. And as always, we want to track as much of that as we can on a map. So let's look at verses 1 to 9. That Abraham was old and he sent out his servant. Who was that? We don't know. Most speculate that that's the servant that was mentioned in chapter 15 and in verse 2, Eliezer. So you might make a marginal note, perhaps that's Eliezer. If that's not who that is, we don't know who that is. We don't know the name. It's been a number of years since we've seen him in chapter 15. It's kind of like the burial place. I don't know. That's the only one I can think that as far as a name of a servant. But anyway, this is his oldest servant. And so what does he ask his servant to promise him, swear to him? Yeah, I don't want you to find a wife from the Canaanites. I want you to go find to my homeland, to my people. And he asked him to put his hand under his thigh, which we have a question about what does that mean. That's just he does that as an oath. As you would go to court, you may be asked to put your hand on a Bible and raise your right hand and make the promise or affirm that you're telling the truth. And I want you to put your hand under my thigh. This is a form of taking an oath. And I want you to swear that you will not do that. But I want you to go among my people. Now, what else does he say in this promise? Yeah, the servant asked, well, what if they may not want to I go out and talk to this woman, to this girl, and ask her to come back with me. She may not want to come, so why don't I take the son? You want me to do that? You may take Isaac. No, don't take Isaac. But you promise me you won't take Isaac, and you go, but what if they don't come? What did Abraham say to him? You're released from that, and you're not going to be held accountable for that. All right, that gets us down to verses 1 to 9. A couple of comments now. Back up about verse 4. Why did he not want a daughter of the Canaanites when Abraham had already taken Hagar as a wife? She was an Egyptian. She was not of his people. And later he's going to take another woman. So why did he do that? We're not told. There is some conjecture here. Seemingly to protect Isaac, and in knowing that Isaac is the seed promise, to protect the seed from Canaanite influence. That makes sense to me. That he's protecting his seed through whom the earth is going to be blessed. He is the one that God had promised, protecting him and his descendants from Canaanite influence. You say, well, I don't know that that's the case. Well, I'm not sure then what it was, but other than that being the case. But I want to flag this, and we're going to flag this several times. I want you to notice the hand of God throughout this story, that God was guiding the choice, and it's mentioned several times. Now, at verse 7, Abraham said to him, to the servant, that God will send his angel before you, and you shall take a wife for my son from there. Now, we're not told how Abraham either knew that or thought he knew that. Had God told him, I'm going to send my angel? Maybe so, I don't know. Abraham just said, God's going to send his angel, and God will guide you, and God will protect you, and God's going to help you with this. How, I'm not sure. And so you may have some insight to that I don't have, I'll be glad to listen to that. So you might put a star there beside that as a providence passage or a passage of God's hand. We're going to flag several of those through the chapter. All right. Making sense so far? All right. Let's go to the next section now. In 10 to 28, Abraham's servant goes to Nahor and finds Rebekah. And so three things happen in this section. First of all, let's talk about where Nahor is. Nahor is here. Now, Beersheba is where Abraham has been, and we'll come back to Beer-lahai. But Nahor is up here in Mesopotamia, and so that's where he goes to find the wife for Isaac. All right, let's begin now at verse 10. He takes with him 10 camels. We'll make some sense of that in a moment, or make a point about that. Takes with him 10 camels. And so how many men does he take with him? I don't know. Some have suggested maybe as many as 10, because a man for each camel, but they could have led some camels. So there's multiple men going, and then multiple goods they're carrying. So I don't know how many men there were. The text doesn't tell us. And so he makes it to the city of Nahor. All right. Now, when he gets to Nahor, what does he do at verse 11? He knows the customs are for the women to come out and get water at a certain time. All right. He prays to God, give me success this day and show kindness. And so he prays, saying that as I stand here before the well, let it be that the young woman that I say to her, bring me down your pitcher that I may drink. And if she says to me, let me get you drink and then get water for your camels also, let that be the one, here's another verse to flag at verse 14, whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. So the servant is thinking God's going to make the choice. So I'm asking you, God, to let this be the way that you show me this is your choice. You make the choice. Abraham said he'll help you. The angel will help you. Does that make sense? We're flagging God's hand here. It's not just an arbitrary choice that he's going and picking out the best one that looks the best. Make sense? Several times we're going to see that. All right. So that gets us down through verse 14. Now, starting at verse 15, he finds Rebekah. Let's talk about who Rebekah is. And we've talked about this last time. Here is Abram, and he had a brother named Nahor. And we'll go and notice that here's Nahor, who's married to Milcah, and she has a son named Bethuel. And he has at least two children, Rebekah and Laban. We'll talk about Laban in a moment. And so she marries Isaac, who is from Abraham and Sarah. I said last time that she would be a second cousin. That's actually a first cousin once removed, technically. I'm not sure how you remove a cousin. If you can figure out how, I've got some I'd like to remove. But anyway, that's a first cousin once removed, is what technically she is. They were related. And start now at verse 15. Rebekah came, and she offers the drink to him. And then what does she do? She finished giving him drink and then offered for the camels to drink, and until all of them were finished drinking. And then she hastened and emptied her pitcher into the trough and ran back to the well with the water and drew for all the camels. So there's a lot of work. Now, there's 10 camels. One writer made this observation. Look at verse 20 before I make the observation. Two things we want to point out at verse 20. And the man wondering at her. I don't think he's gazing at her like I'm amazed at her. But what's he wondering? I think she's the one. I believe she is the one. And he was silent so as to know whether the Lord had made his journey prosperous or not. Flag that verse. Another verse showing the hand of God in making the choice. Now, for what it's worth, women, you may appreciate this, that one writer said he thought there could be as many as 10 men, one for each camel. Here's five men standing watching this woman do all the work. Not one time did the man offer or any of his servants offer to go help her. She goes and gets water for all the camels. Probably the case. Well, that's true. All right. Verse 22. What do we see in verses 22 to 28? The servant does what? All right, he first gives her two things and then asks her. He gives her a nose ring, which is significant of some degree of wealth. I'm told several scholars mention that was a sign of wealth. not in our day, but it was for that day, and gave her bracelets that were quite wealthy. It was something that her brother took notice of as soon as she comes up in a few moments. He takes notice of all of that. And then he asked, who are you, and is there a place to lodge? He gave her gifts and asked, is there lodging? Is there a place where I can stay? Now, I want you to notice at verse 25, she said, yes, we have room and to spare, etc. But now verse 26 and 27 and 28. The man bowed down and worshiped God. Here's another verse to flag. He thinks the Lord has blessed him here, and we have found the woman. What does he say at verse 27? Absolutely, yes. That he has not forsaken, and he's shown his truth toward my master. As for me, being on the way, the Lord has led me to the house. In other words, the Lord's picked this woman. This is the one. I'm convinced this is the woman that God intended for us to have. And so, again, that's four times already we've seen Abraham saying, the servant saying, the Lord is guiding in this, and the Lord has picked this woman. Now, let's shift gears now. And let's talk about Rebecca's family is told of the choice, and they send her off. So what happens now when she comes to the household? Who is Laban? We talked about him just a moment ago. That's her brother. She comes out, and he notices, first of all, the gold ring in her nose, the bracelets. What else? She begins to tell him, well, about this man that she's met out at the well, and where's what he said? I'm reading it verse 30. So he went out to see what was going on. And he comes to the conclusion, oh, blessed of the Lord. He understands this man is from God. Had he concluded that from his conversation with Rebecca? Or was there something else that took place that we're not told? He concludes this man is a blessed man of God. What else happens down through verse 49? All right, take care of the camels, and then they put a meal before him, but he said, before I eat, I want to tell you my mission here. Well, here's what's going on and how I got here and why I come to this house. Why I asked to come home with your daughter here. And so he gets to telling about Abraham, tells all the history of Abraham and how he's been blessed and how he had a son. Now we drop down to verse 40. Here we go, flag this verse again. Here's another verse where God's hand is involved. Same story being told a second time. He said, I prayed to God about this matter, and before I got through talking to God, God sent his, he said to me, the Lord... go before, or Abraham had said to me, I'm getting ahead of myself, that the angel will prosper your way. So my master said, God's going to prosper my way. And then he said, I went and I prayed, and before I got through, here's the details, verse 40, 41, 40, down through verse 46. I got out there, and here she come. All right. Now that gets us down to about verse, I know we're going a little bit fast with reference to that. Let's go to verse 48. This is where he said, and I bowed my head and I worshiped and I blessed the Lord, and Abraham has led me to the way of truth to take the daughter of my master, brother, for his son. And so, again, you might flag verse 48 as a verse indicating God's hand is in the matter. Verse 50, closely connected. We're ready to start the next little subsection. Rebecca sent away by her family. What's said at verse 50 that makes you want to flag that? Yeah, this is the brother, and the daddy came to the conclusion from listening to all that, this thing came from the Lord, and we cannot speak either good, bad, or good. In other words, we can't fight the Lord. We can't go against it, and we can't make it any better. We just go with what the Lord said. This is the Lord's work. The Lord has chosen her. So they came to that conclusion. All right, what do they do now? The servant goes, this is Abraham's servant goes and gets more gold and silver, and brings more gifts out for her, and gave some things to her brother and to her mother. And they then sat down and they ate and they drank. And in the morning, they were ready to go off. But the mother said, can you blame her? Let's wait a little bit. How long does she want to wait? 10 days. And his response to that was, we're ready to flag a verse again. Verse 56. Yeah. Do not hinder me, since the Lord has prospered my way. Send me away that I may go to my master. Here again, the Lord's prospered. The Lord's blessed us. This is the Lord's choice. So again and again and again and again and again, the statement has been made, the Lord's going to make the choice. The Lord will make the choice. The Lord has made the choice. The Lord has prospered. The Lord's answered our prayer. This is it. This is the answer. We've got the answer we've been looking for. So don't hinder me. I must get back. And we're doing the Lord's will. So they suggested, why don't we, let's ask Rebecca herself. And Rebecca's response was, I will go. And so they send her away. Now what's the point of verse 60? At verse 60, they said to her, our sister, may you become the mother of thousands and of 10,000s, and may your descendants possess the gates of those that hate them. Yes. I'm gathering that the conversations that we've been looking at are not complete. The record is not complete. I don't mean there's something missing. That just means God's told us what he wanted us to see. But there must have been more in this conversation. Either that or they had prior knowledge of the promise to Abraham somehow, and they think that she's going to be part of the descendant. Her descendants will be thousands and many. And may your descendants possess the gate of those that hate them. That's may they domineer over their enemies. May they conquer over their enemies. May their enemies not defeat them. That's the idea. May they conquer their gates. That's the point. Now, she's sent away with a nurse at verse 59 and maids, verse 61. Again, significance of some wealth on the family's part, sending her to Abraham or to Isaac, who has wealth. But that's significant of wealth. Others have suggested the riding of the camels at verse 61, that was not common for people, common people to ride a camel. That was more for people of wealth. And so be that as it may, there seems to be she's sent off well blessed. Here's your nurse, here's your maids, here's camels, and let's go and send you back to Isaac as the Lord has indeed blessed. So she took off with the servant and she departed. All right. Now the last section of this chapter is Isaac and Rebekah meet and they marry. Now, this obviously is an arranged marriage, as well as the custom. That's kind of unusual in our minds. But the text tells us that Isaac came from the way of Beer-lahai-Roi, Haroi rather, Lahairoi, for he dwelt in the south. Now let's see where that is. That was just below Beersheba. And the way of the south, or Negev, if you're translating, I believe the English Standard, instead of using the word south, that's the region here to the south of the Dead Sea. And he came from that direction, the text says, and Rebekah saw him, and she asked, who is that man? Well, that's my master, that's Isaac. And so they met, and she covered herself with a veil, and the servant told Isaac all that had done. In other words, he went through the whole story. This is how I picked her out, is because I prayed to God. This was God's choice. And so he took her, and he loved her, and he married her, and now they are joined together. All right. That's the longest chapter in the book of Genesis. We won't find another one longer. Big chapter. All right, questions or comments before we get to chapter 25? So So we've had a death, a burial, and we've had searching for a wife, and we've got her, and they're married, and now we're ready to move on to another marriage and another death and some birth and some fighting. We got a lot going on in chapter 25. Make sense? All right, here we go. Chapter 25, we have Abraham's death, the birth of Jacob and Esau. All right, let's start with the Abraham's, if I can find my notes. Start with Abraham's marriage to Keturah. Verses 1 to 6 now, let's get that. Verses 1 to 6, Abraham marries Keturah, and let's see who she is. Now, Keturah, we have here Abram always, on these little charts, the cross represents the lineage through whom the Messiah is going to come, so Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So here we have Abraham and Sarah. He has Ishmael by Hagar. Well, here is Keturah, and here are the six sons that she has. The significance that we want to make of this, though there's more to be made, I want you to notice that one of her sons' name was Midian. This is the one through whom the Midianites come. Now, the Midianites made up the land of Midian. You can tell from this is the land of Canaan up here. This is the Dead Sea. You can barely make out. So right here is the land of Midian, and that's where these sons are the sons of Midian settled. That would be the Midianites. Well, we go a little bit further at verse 5. He gave all that he had to Isaac. Why? He's the son of the promise. And then verse 6 says he gave gifts to his to the sons of his concubines and sent them away to the country of the east. All right, let's go back. Connected with Midian, this is the region. To get your bearings, here is the Dead Sea right in that circle. This is the Sinai Peninsula. This is Egypt over here. This is the region generally thought of as the East Country. That's where they went. In other words, he got them away from Isaac and from his descendants. He sent them away. Does that make sense? Seems like Abraham has a concept that I want to get everybody else away from Isaac and his family and his descendants. Now, they're going to intermingle a little bit later. We'll get to that, and there's indeed a problem. All right, now let's go back to our outline. He marries Keturah, then Abraham dies. So let's look at verses 7 through 11. At verse 7, the sum of Abraham's life, how long did he live? 175. So here's some timing or chronology notes. Again, I'm generally following Klassen's chronology. You may be following someone else, so don't get excited if we vary. At 175, that was going to put us about 527 years since the flood. And you may be looking at a different number, close to that, but don't get excited. These are just general terms. 527 years since the flood, 2183 years since Adam. And all I'm interested in is getting a general concept, not exact numbers, because everybody's chronology doesn't agree. So we're looking at over 500, so 527, so over 500 years since the flood, and almost 2,200 years since Adam. Make sense? Timetable? All right. Now then, Abraham died at a good old age. I'm reading at verse 8, a man full of years and was gathered to his people. That's an interesting phrase. The text doesn't just say he died, he was gathered to his people. You might make a marginal note. That is a statement of belief in life beyond the grave. That is an affirmation of hope beyond the grave. He was gathered to his people. And we won't take the time to develop that. But that does give us that concept. Now, his sons buried him. Where'd they bury Abraham? At the same cave of Machpelah. Abraham came and dwelt at Beerah Lahai-Roi, as we've already noted, just below Beersheba as we had it on the map just a minute ago. All right. Questions or comments so far? All right, let's finish. See, we've got a little ways to go. Now, Ishmael's family in his death, in verses 12 to 18. We're not going to spend a lot of time here. This is the genealogy of Ishmael, the son of Hagar the Egyptian. And then we have the names. But what I'm interested in is he died at verse 17 at the age of 137. So he is the father of the Ishmaelites. Where did they settle? Well, notice at verse 18, they dwelt from Havilah as far as Shur, which is east of Egypt as you go toward Assyria. All right, if you can get your bearing here, this is the Sinai Peninsula. This is Saudi Arabia. It's this region right here, according to Brother Rudd, and he's done quite a bit of work on this area, that this is the territory of the Ishmaelites. But from Havilah, down here toward the south, all the way back up here toward Shur, it's that region where the Ishmaelites would settle. And so he is the, we'll come across the Ishmaelites a little bit later. Now let's go back. We're trying to finish here. Let's talk about the birth of Jacob and Esau. Isaac was 40 years old, the text tells us, when he took a wife, verse 20. And by the time we get to their birth, at verse 26, 20 years have passed. He's 60 years old. So 20 years goes by in a flash here. Look at verse 22. The children struggled within her while they're in her womb, and she's wondering and wanted to know why, what's going on. And the Lord's answer to that was, that's really two nations in you. In other words, here are the heads of two nations that are in you and that'll be at odds. Now you might make a marginal note to the side. That's the nation of the Edomites and the Israelites. Jacob being the one from whom the Israelites come. Esau is the father of the Edomites. Make sense? You're going to see Edom mentioned in our context down at verse 30. Now, the Edomites were located just south of the Dead Sea. And you remember they had trouble getting around going into the land. The Edomites wouldn't let them cross. There are two nations that were at odds. So two nations. All right. The one, Esau, was the first. And the Lord said to her, the older shall serve the younger. That's not normally the case, is it? But the older shall serve the younger. Now, verse 27 says, the boys grew and Esau was a skillful hunter and Jacob was a mild man dwelling in tents. The English Standard translates, he was a quiet man. NASBY, that is New American Standard Bible, translates that he was a peaceful man. In other words, he stayed close to the tents. He stayed close to camp. Where his brother's going off hunting, he stays close to camp. And was peaceful and quiet. Now let's get this last section and connect it with Hebrews 12 and we'll be done. Beginning at verse 29 through verse 34, Esau sells his birthright. What happens in this story? Jacob has cooked some stew, some red stew. Yeah, he wanted some of that red stew. Now notice verse 30 says that his name will be called Edom, which means red. So where did the name Edomites come from? From Esau's descendants because of his connection with this red stew. So Jacob was cunning, the text tells us, and he said, sell me your birthright this day. Well, the birthright was a double portion and ruling over the family. So the one who was the eldest had the birthright, would be the ruler over the family, and the younger would serve them. Plus he got a double portion of the inheritance. So if you want some of this stew, you can have it, but sell me your birthright in exchange. And he said, I'm about to die, so what profit is my birthright? And so he sold it to him. And verse 34 says, Esau despised his birthright. He didn't have wisdom to see the value of his birthright. Now, I want to connect that with Hebrews chapter 12. You might make a marginal note. Time's not going to permit us to get in detail. But let's quickly go over to Hebrews 12. And notice a comment that's made at verse 16 and 17. Lest there be any fornicator or profane person like Esau. Profane person. Godless, your footnote may say. Lest there be any godless person like Esau, who for one morsel of food sold his birthright. And then verse 17 said that afterward, when he wanted to inherit the blessings, he was rejected and found no place for repentance, though he diligently sought it with tears. He later regretted. Too late, though. Too late. He then sold his birthright. Make sense? So now chapter 12 of Hebrews is going to make some sense to us. We had a lot of ground to cover to make it through our story, but you might flag Hebrews 12, 16, and 17 as a comment on that last section. All right. Time is gone. We'll pick up with chapter 26 next time.